Sugar?
Are you thinking about this?
Not sugar, pretty sweet.
Normally, I...
But sugar is also...
Okay, I have to go open them. Heavenly Father, I thank you so much for this beautiful morning, Lord, and muffins and friends, Lord, and I just...
Well, I don't want to spill it and make a mess out of it.
Father, I just thank you all together. Just look at awesome looking people you have just been through, Lord, pray that you just help us gain everything from it that you want us to, Lord, and that that we would see it clearly and be able to understand some of the difficult things there and really just gain joy and truth for our lives from it. Thank you for Dr. Dalton being here this morning and for taking time to share with us this morning. And I just pray for those who are coming up here that you just hurry their arrival. Thank you again for today and what you have for us.
Thanks for having me come by again. I love to hang out with all of you.
Good.
We're in the book of Ecclesiastes today, which is in the Old Testament in the clean pages of your Bible.
It doesn't open in that section.
It's all stuck. Your Bible probably says that this is the words of the preacher. That's probably how it opened. The Hebrew is the word kohelet, which does not mean preacher. It means a searcher, an investigative reporter, somebody who goes and studies something and reports back on it. So this is not the words of the preacher. That's one of the first clues. This is an investigative report into life and what the investigator found when he went through this very elaborate search. And it's a very marvelous book. There's no reason to believe this was written by anybody other than King Solomon, who was the king in Israel after the death of his father, King David. Remember that Solomon was born to Bathsheba after David and Bathsheba committed adultery and David got rid of her husband Uriah. He married Bathsheba and had this son. And the name Solomon, of course, is related to the word shalom, which means peace. The Hebrew word for peace means that kind of peace which comes from being a whole person. Shalom. May the peace of God come down on you. When Solomon was born, God gave him an intimate name. He gave him the name Jedidiah as the second name. Jedidiah means beloved of the Lord, which is an intimate term that shows that right from birth, God loved Solomon in a very special way. The name of God, Elohim, Elohim is the compound name for God, occurs 28 times, but the name Jehovah, Yahweh, isn't in this book at all. Elohim is the name of God you ran onto in Genesis 1, the plural noun that takes singular verbs, Elohim, three or more persons. Now, Solomon, if you go back to 2 Chronicles and look at the, which we won't do, and look at the early period of his reign, he had a magnificent prayer when he dedicated the temple. He spent 14 years building himself a very nice house and 7 years building this magnificent temple. His father David had accumulated great amounts of building material and vast quantities of gold and silver. And King David had also brought peace to the kingdom by conquering and subduing all the enemies of Israel, so that during Solomon's 40-year reign, the land was at peace and very, very prosperous. And Solomon was very, very wealthy. Also, Samuel says that God gave Solomon wisdom above the kings of all the east, that he was by far the wisest man in the ancient world, 3,000 years ago. And then it says God gave him largeness of mind like the sand of the seashore. We might call that expanded consciousness or maybe a broad encyclopedic understanding of all of life. So he's eminently well qualified to talk to us. Now if you read a little bit further into the book of Chronicles, the life of Solomon, you'll find out that he started his reign as king very, very well. but he had this weakness for foreign wives. He married the daughter of Pharaoh, and when Pharaoh moved into Jerusalem, she brought her idols with her. But it didn't stop there, because he ended up with 700 wives and 300 concubines. And then there's that little understatement in the Bible that says his wives turned his heart away from the Lord, which you can imagine what happened. So by making all these alliances with foreign nations, by marrying all these foreign women, he allowed idolatry to creep into Israel, and he also abandoned his own relationship with the Lord for many years. The Jewish tradition, not in the Bible, talks about these years in which he got away from the Lord and consulted with the prince of demons and did all kinds of things. However, there's before he got away from the Lord, he wrote Song of Solomon, and he wrote 1,005 fine songs, which we don't have. It seems that at the end of his life, when he finally woke up again to the fact that he'd gotten away from God, came back to the Lord, and that's very likely that that's when he wrote Ecclesiastes. So Ecclesiastes is kind of his summary of all the things he learned in his 40 years of being king and in his long lifespan. So this is a very good book, then, that tells us about all the things in life that don't work, based on the experience of a very wise man who did this investigative reporting. So this is part of the book. Now, this, a lot of people think that this book is about how life is vain and lacking in purpose. And that's because the word vanity comes all the way through here. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, vanity of vanities, says the searchers, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. We have the English word vanity, which means vain or proud, but that's not what it means here. Vanity, a vanity mirror, you know what that is? The girls have vanity mirrors. I don't think it's a term we use anymore, but a vanity mirror is where you put on your makeup and think, look and see how beautiful you are, and there's no fairer one anywhere. The word vanity here means what? Vanity, vanity, all is vanity.
Kind of like void or...
Void?
Not, like
empty?
Empty?
Accomplishes nothing?
Superficial.
If you say he lived his life in vain, it would mean that in the net analysis, you have nothing to show for your whole life. Say, that would be now. So
worthless.
Pardon me.
Worthless.
Worthless. That's right. The word.
The actual meaning of that.
Okay. So he introduces himself as the son of David. So we think that it's all the words of the searcher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, vanity of vanity, says the searcher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? That would be very existential. What is the purpose of my life? Why am I here for all this hard work? What am I gaining? Hello? Come in. Wonderful. Great. Scott. Some very key people here. The two Nicks. Hi. Thanks for coming. Just took Dr. Henthorne's chair. But
No. Please.
Stay there. Do you guys all know the two of my friends? Nick and Nick.
Nick and Nick.
I don't know.
They
got
their own bathroom.
Yeah. And there's muffins. And we just started Ecclesiastes. It's just very minute. Just started.
Sorry. Keep going.
Okay.
So you want this? You don't want this?
Totally effort.
Okay. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? That would be the sense of meaningless and despair in life. Now we're going to find out why Solomon finds this sense of despair in life, and he is searching. He's doing this investigative report of everything that he can look at. He's got all the money that he needs. He's got time, he's got power, he's got servants, he's already wise, and he sets himself out to explore everything. It's a far better education than we would ever get. But, all right, the first thing would be, he contemplates the cycles of nature. One generation passes away, another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. Now that's kind of interesting if you stop and think about it. Look at these hills around San Jose here. How long have they been here? And how long will you be here in comparison? The hills are permanent as far as we're concerned. They've been here for thousands and thousands of years, and you'll be here 70 or 80 years at most. And that's exactly backwards from what it ought to be. You'd think that man would be permanent and nature would be temporary. But it's exactly the other way around. He looks out and he says, nature appears to be permanent and human life is so transitory, it's so fleeting, it goes right by. One generation passes away, another generation comes, and yet the earth remains forever. The sun rises, the sun goes down, and hastens to its place where it arose. The wind goes towards the south and around to the north. The wind whirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. So he looks at nature, seasons. Every single year we get winter, summer, fall, spring, and it goes round and round and round. When you're young, it's kind of exciting because you can't wait for spring and it'll be nice to have winter again. But after a while, after 50 years, this same old cycle, it doesn't have the vitality it once had. Yeah.
In the southern hemisphere, the seasons are reversed.
That's right. In the southern hemisphere,
instead of winter, they have summer.
That's right. Exactly opposite from where we are.
I mean, I should know that firsthand. I was born somewhere where the seasons were in reverse.
So he sees the streams falling, the rivers all running continually into the sea, but the sea never fills up and the rivers never stop flowing.
Well, that's empty into the ocean.
Yeah, that's the hydrologic cycle. Why does the ocean never fill up, and why do the rivers always flow? This is 3000 BC. Well, there's evaporation going on, and there's waters evaporating from the ocean and forming clouds, and the clouds come over the land, and it rains, and the rains fill the rivulets and the creeks and the rivers, and that's this cycle in nature goes on year after year after year after year. It's quite independent of how long you live or how long you're here. So the first thing Solomon does is he looks at the natural physical world that he lives in. Then he says something here.
The hills actually have been around for about 10,000 years.
Yeah, that's right. About that, that's right. Exactly. All things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. That true? No matter how long you've lived, you never get tired of seeing new scenery, seeing a new movie, meeting a new face. Our eyes are always restless. We're always want to see what's around the next bend in the road. And do you ever get tired of hearing things, of hearing music, or being? No, you never do. No matter how old you are, even real old people in an old folks' home like to have somebody come and talk to them. Or like to look at pictures or old photographs, or that's something about our humanity is this restless, wanting to learn, wanting to live, wanting to participate. But is it ever satisfied? Is it ever fulfilled? Now he says something interesting. That which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done, and there's nothing new under the sun. Is that true? Nothing new under the sun? 3,000 years ago, he says, the things that have occurred previously will occur again. There's nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it may be said, look, this is really new? And Solomon says, no, it's already been in ancient times before. But there is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who come after. Now that's very interesting. What's that mean? We think modern civilization, we're learning things we've never learned before right now. Modern civilization is advancing. We're wiser and smarter. Oh, I just got a brilliant new idea that will change all of the world today.
But computers are new, aren't they?
Well, old idea, but just new manifestation.
What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, the definition of a computer is basically just a machine.
A machine for learning.
For learning, which we've been creating for 3,000 years.
So one generation very quickly forgets all the wisdom that they had, and the next generation learns it all over again. And new movements, new philosophies show up in history, and everybody jumps on the bandwagon and says, boy, this is great, but it's really not anything new after all.
Doing the same thing as history repeats itself.
History repeats itself. So if you were to live 10 human lifetimes, you'd see all these cycles coming and going again, and nothing's really new.
There are some individuals who have been around for such a long time that, like, they're like people, but like half their genetics is out of an animal.
We meet some of them.
There is one that we do know of. There is.
See what Solomon's claim here. Solomon's claim from 3,000 years ago is there's really nothing new in the human race as far as philosophies, wisdom, knowledge, insight, that his search is the same as anybody's search, that every generation goes through the same patterns, you experience life in the same way. Philosophies, ideologies, ways of thinking are recycled. One generation forgets when they get discovered. Isn't that kind of a sense of futility that you think about? Life appears to be very futile, one generation right after another. When you're young, you're all full of enthusiasm and discovery and learning stuff, and when you get old, it means little. And then you die in the neck, and your kids learn it all over again. So, in other words, life doesn't appear to be going anywhere. If you consider by natural reason, he couldn't find out that life was headed anywhere. Now there's a little missing secret here in this book, and that is Solomon in his search is excluding God through all and until the end of the book, and then he says, no, he says there is actually an answer to things, but the answer will elude you if God is left out of what you're thinking. So I'm giving you a little clue. Verse 12, I, the searcher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem.
So is he not king anymore when he wrote this?
Oh, it's the end of his life. He died still king. He was still king when he died. And his kingdom was fought over and divided into two parts, if you remember.
Yeah.
So I think he's recounting his whole life looking back on it. Can't prove it was Solomon, but it most likely was. I set my heart, he tells us now what his search is about. I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. I set on a deliberate investigation of everything I could think of in all of life, in all areas of life, and he had money, and he had knowledge, and he had libraries, and he had resources, and great wisdom and great skill. So he's going to go systematically about this. And he says, I wanted to search out this grievous task God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised. You see the kind of the futility there and the sense of humor? God put you down here to search and toil and look around for the meaning of life, and it may very well elude you. You see that? And so he's, is there an answer to all this? I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed, all is vanity and a grasping after the wind. What do you have to show when you've made your millions, or got your Nobel Prize, or married the perfect partner, or had, what do you have to show for your life? So there's a kind of a cynicism in here. that fits very much the times in which we live now. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. Did you ever try to get the kinks out of life or fix something that was wrong in a relationship or go make correct a mistake that you made a couple of years ago? There'd be a lot of things in life that are fixed and unalterable. Our circumstances, all those things. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be numbered. I communed with my heart, saying, "Look, I have attained greatness. I have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly." This is the first category of his major search, is he's going to look through the wisdom of mankind and through all that he knew about wisdom. And he wanted to even explore madness and folly. Madness, he didn't mind psychedelic drugs and going crazy because he'd like to know what it would be like to be drunk out of your mind or crazy out of your mind. He would like to see what foolishness is all about, just to see what it's like. So he could say, "I've been there. I know what it's like to be an utter fool. Or I know what it's like to be mad. And I've been there, seen it, and I understand. I can explain that to you if you want it." And what did he find? He says, it's all just grasping after wind. Grasping at straws. Can you imagine trying to grab the wind with your hand? This figure of speech, grasping after wind. In much wisdom is much grief. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. So what's that about? You got to come in and think these things in contemporary terms a little bit.
Ignorance is bliss.
Ignorance is bliss, yeah. That's the converse, isn't it?
So he's saying, like, the more he finds out about the world, the more bad stuff he finds out about it, and so it was better when he didn't know anything.
There's something to be said for the simple life, for the farmer who gets out and plants his crops and does his harvest and sits back in the rocking chair in front of the fireplace and sings old ballads or something like that, and doesn't bother himself with TV and books and learning, and just lives a simple life. I'm sure sometimes you guys would like to be living a simple life.
Even kind of like childhood, I
think. Look at how innocent childhood is. Until you get into school and they start making you learn a bunch of stuff. Then you can play and explore, and everything's kind of new and fresh. But the more you know about life, the more complicated it is, the more mystery there is, and the more it's unsolvable. And piles of knowledge, what do you do? It's just kind of burns you out after a while. So there's futility. So why are you guys going to college? See, what's it going to do you in the long run? Well, it must be in order to be more money, have more money in order to please your parents, in order to live a better life. But Solomon looks beyond that and he says, no, that's all in and of itself. That's not, it has no meaning.
I'm quitting right now.
Well, I got a note from the president of the university. He said that we had too many students, and if I could help get some of them to drop out, I could get a little fee. Get $5 for everyone that drops out. So far, so good. Here's a man that's forgotten about God, who once knew the Lord, and he's put God on the shelf, and he says, I'm going to go find the meaning of life. And I'm going to do it systematically. So I'm going to read books. I'm going to go study things. I'm going to go investigate philosophy and lifestyles and make a very thorough inventory of everything and see what I find. And so far, nothing.
Yeah, but a lot of people also close their Christians and fall away and do what they want.
But this is not like the ordinary Christian who falls away and just goes and parties, say, or checks up with somebody or just goes and lives, abandons himself or herself to just a... No, he's systematic about this. That's the one thing about him. The searching skeptic. And the fact that he wrote this book means that he wanted us to learn what he found. And in the end, he's going to tell us that, no, there is meaning to all of life when God is in the equation. So we're going to anticipate that. So this is not a book about futility and despair. It's a book about life is meaningless if Jesus is excluded from your daily life. Or from any area of your life. Any area of your life in which Jesus has been shut out will be an area of your life of darkness and emptiness and futility. That's what makes this such a good book. Is there anything wrong with the study of philosophy or wisdom or the accumulation of knowledge inherently? No. Nothing inherently wrong with those things. A lot of fundamentalist type Christians think that staying out of the world means staying away from knowledge and staying away from learning. And
didn't Paul say something about how philosophy or the study of philosophy was bad or something like that?
The wisdom of this world is foolishness to God. 1 Corinthians 10. The wisdom of this world is foolishness to God. Now that's worldly wisdom. But there's really two kinds of wisdom. There's godly wisdom and there's worldly wisdom. So it would be, what are your presuppositions behind wisdom? All right, so far? See this book? I said in my heart, come now, I'll test you with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure. So now having studied, having read a lot of books and gone into wisdom and madness and foolishness and this intellectual side of life, he says, no, I'm going to now go on a big intensive search for pleasure. I'm going to try a California hedonistic lifestyle, like most of the people around here live. Eat, drink, and be merry, tomorrow we die. So now he's got money and he can afford to do it, and he says, I'm going to have a good time because I've got too much school and I need a break and I need to go discover this. But surely this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is madness. And of mirth, what does it accomplish?
What is mirth?
Mirth?
Merriment?
Yeah, merriment. Why would laughter be madness? Somebody tells a really uproariously funny story, and we all just think it's hilariously funny, and we all laugh, and it feels good to laugh, doesn't it? But what would happen if we got stuck laughing and we were laughing for 4 hours? We could breathe.
Dang, that would hurt.
It would hurt. So, and if you made your whole life was built around laughing, and you got all these books on, all these joke books, and you listened to, how long would that last as a viable lifestyle?
Have you seen Mary Poppins? You know that? It's like, it's stuck laughing forever,
yeah,
or whatever.
Stuck,
and it's
yeah,
like,
stuck laughing. And mirth? Mirth would be merry. Merrymaking is having a bunch of friends over and having a great dinner and catching up with a bunch of people and talking and have 4 or 5 hours of just a wonderful, delightful time. And then what? Then what? Well, you got to go clean up the kitchen and everybody's tired and the house is a mess and everybody leaves. And it's all over with and it fades. So what if you made your whole life doing that? One party after another, one celebration after that, then where would you be? Where would you end up? Where does it leave in and of itself?
Poor
house. It leads to poverty. Right?
Yeah, don't.
I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom. He tried to get pleasantly drunk without losing self-control. He tried to explore what it feels like to get slightly drunk on too much wine. That's great, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of fun to get mellowed out on a little bit of wine, but not to the point where you start getting crazy. And he sets out to do this deliberately. Toured the Napa Vineyards and went on a wine tasting weekend up there and had just a great time. But his whole time he was conscious of his mind, got my heart guiding me with wisdom. I want to analyze this while it's going on. and I wanted to lay hold on foolishness, folly, until I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. Sons and daughters of men. What is a good life? What is the good life? He wanted to find out, people talk about the good life, living the good life. I like it out here in California because, you know, you can live the good life out here. Get a nice climate, get yourself a good job, and live in a nice house up in the hills, and go skiing, and go wine tasting, and go boating, and just, it's a good life, right? So let's suppose you had time and money, you could go do that for 5 years, and write a report on what I learned in living the good life. Well, you could write a book, you could write your memoirs, but Solomon's smart enough to see, where did that lead me? With some nice memories, maybe a few hangovers. What if you did all of this and then you died, then what? What do you have to show? How long will it be before you're totally forgotten? It won't be very long. I made my works great. He's got a lot of money now. I made my works great. I built houses and planted vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. The pools of Solomon are still in existence. Solomon made great reservoirs near Bethlehem, great, huge, huge reservoirs to catch the rainwater and pipe it into Jerusalem where his palace was. So he had these enormous botanical gardens. Enormous. And here's a man that knew all about plants, imported plants from all over the world, and grew everything he could think of, all kinds of fruits and nuts and flowers in his garden, so he can have the most magnificent garden in the world. And he's very, very wealthy, and so he's going to make it so attractive that it'll be a world-famous garden. And he can walk through his garden, like P. Allen Smith does on TV, and talk and give you the technical names for all the plants and when they bloom and how to water them and take care of them. Wouldn't it be nice to have the time and money to do that? Make the most beautiful garden in the world and get the most wonderful plants. Some of them have to be under a dome for climate control. And then it would be a nice monument because people would say, who built that magnificent garden over there?
The garden starts still there, right?
Oh. Sure,
the garden's not there anymore.
So he himself, houses and vineyards and gardens and orchards and fruit trees, all kinds of exotic trees. And water, it's a dry climate over there, so you have to irrigate things in Jerusalem. Now, I acquired male and female servants. I had servants born in my house. I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. Now, he doesn't go into for plants and vegetables and fruits. He gets some pasture land, and so he raises sheep and goats and cattle and emus and gazelles and tigers and lions and water buffalo and all kinds of exotic animals. So he has a zoo, a great zoo, with vast lands. And so you can go on all day long. You can go study all the animals in your zoo, like taking a trip to Kenya or something. And he's got plenty of servants, got a lot of money, so he can pay these servants, and all he's got to do is give the order and they go out and water the trees and feed the animals and take care of them. Look at your great empire.
What does that mean when he says that I have had servants born in my house? Does that mean that he just has a lot of servants? And that
servants and generations of servants and servants, loyal family servants. In the days when people in the Roman Empire had about 60% of the population were slaves or servants, but here these were domestic servants. And being very wealthy, he could hire them, and they were like family. So he treated them like family and housed them in his palace, and they raised their children. So there's a whole family of servants that are there, growing up in his household. Incredibly rich man. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and the provinces of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kinds, and I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem, and yet my wisdom remained with me. Now here's a man then that is the king, and he throws lavish parties with orchestras and musicians and exotic dancers. And and he invites in foreign royalty. And they can come into his palace and sit before the king and have a lavish meal set out before them and have this music like the White House. In the White House they have nice concerts and leading artists and musicians. We have one very good example of this going on in the visit of the Queen of Sheba. Remember, let's read that just for fun. Let's just find it. The Queen of Sheba. Sheba is, where is the land of Sheba?
It's not Ethiopia.
Ethiopia or southern Arabia. And it's down, so this is a desert princess, a very wealthy woman. And if we can find out her visit. Find out the visit of the Queen of Sheba. Oh, it's supposed to be an early first chance. So far so good? Are we chapter 10 of 1 Kings? So far so good. You get the general drift of what the guy's doing? He's living it up. But he's doing it thoughtfully.
He's like scientifically partying.
Scientifically partying.
Didn't a reporter back in the 70s do that? And I think they made a movie about it.
Could be.
Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, I think, was the movie. But this guy who like did all these kind of psychedelic drugs and stuff and then reported it. Okay.
Ken Kesey?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is that kind of
thing? Yeah, that's exactly the same kind of systematic quest, yeah.
Did you do something like this?
Yeah. Still doing it. isn't that a temptation to pull back from the culture and say, I want to get out of the rat race, I'm going to go find my own path. I'm going to go get a boat and sail around the world, or I'm going to disappear into the jungles and live a native life or drop out. Isn't that tempting to... Well, here's a man that did it and could afford it. Solomon, of course, built the temple, the magnificent temple. His father had acquired all the lumber and all the building material, and he hired the Hiram king of Tyre to come down and build this magnificent temple. Which, when it was all done, it had cedar from Lebanon and had gold and silver, tons of gold and silver lining the walls, and it was a magnificent building. And now we get, in chapter 10, when the Queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. Now this is a lot right in there. First of all, this is, 1,000 miles away, clear all the way, and no internet, no telephones, no television, no CNN, and yet the fame of Solomon was known all over the ancient world. And this would have been by caravan. People would travel by caravan with a bunch of soldiers and guards and then camels or donkeys carrying whatever it was and making long treks across all the trade routes in the east.
How long would it take to get from Ethiopia to Jerusalem?
Months.
Yeah.
Months. So you'd have, if you're doing in a caravan, and this is a royal caravan, the queen is coming to see King Solomon, so she's got to have food and servants and household staff
and gifts, right? Hmm? Wouldn't she be in gifts too?
And gifts, we'll see. Let's see what happens. Now look what it says. She heard the fame of Solomon about in what regard? concerning the Lord. So this is early in the life of Solomon. This is when he was still walking very closely with the Lord, and the Lord was giving him all this reputation. So the rumor was going around the whole ancient world that this King Solomon was an awesome dude and incredible, wealthy, and amazing, and but he can answer questions on any subject in the world. And she came to test him with hard questions. That's kind of, this woman, she's rich, she's ruling over a whole people down in Arabia, and she decides she's going to make this long journey, put the kingdom in the hands of a prime minister, and take this long journey up, because she's got a bunch of questions that she wants to ask Solomon, and they're tough questions. And they're concerning the Lord. So here we are. She came to Jerusalem with a very great retinue, camels that bore spices and much gold and precious stones. When she came to Solomon, she spoke with him about all that was on her heart. So Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing so difficult for the king that he could not explain it to her. That's pretty amazing. Now, I don't know how long this took. It could have taken weeks and weeks and weeks of them getting together every morning for brunch and breakfast and hanging out in the gardens and talking hour upon hour upon hour. And he answered all her questions, and there was none too difficult. When the queen of Sheba had seen all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food on his table, the seating of his servants, the service of his waiters and their apparel, his cupbearers, his entryway by which he went up to the house of the Lord to the temple, there was no more spirit in her. What does that mean? No more spirit in her. She's blown away. That's exactly right.
She was blown away.
I imagine coming to this guy, they could answer all the questions and had this lavish. She's blown away.
Make a movie about this.
Then she said to the king, "It was a true report which I heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom. However, I did not believe the words until I came and saw it with my own eyes, and indeed the half has not been told me." There's an old hymn, I don't know if you've ever heard that old hymn. We don't see it anymore. "The half has not been told." That's a kind of an old revival hymn about God. The half of it has not been told. You haven't heard half of this story. That's me. It's a kind of a... You think I've told you something incredible, you haven't heard it. You haven't heard the first part. That's it. "Your wisdom and prosperity exceed the fame of which I heard. Happy are your men, and happy are these your servants, who stand continually before you and hear your wisdom." How lucky it is that your staff members get to be around listening to your casual conversations. What I had to come all the way up here to get an appointment, but your staff gets to enjoy your wisdom all day long. "Blessed be the Lord your God, who delighted in you, setting you on the throne of Israel, because the Lord has loved Israel forever. Therefore he made you king to do justice and righteousness." Unfortunately, Solomon forgot that. "Then she gave the king 120 talents of gold and spices in great abundance and precious stones. There never again came such abundance of spices as the Queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon." How much gold is that? A talent is 75 pounds. So she brought almost 1 million ounces of gold at, what, $300?
So 120 times 75.
Yeah, $300 an ounce. And the gold's heavy, so this all has to come on the camels. Camels don't mind if you don't overload them. You can take a few hundred pounds per camel, so... So she brings him. He's already wealthy. He hardly needs 800,000 ounces more of gold. This is just her token offering and spices. There never again came such abundance of spices as the Queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. And the ships of Hiram, which brought gold from Ophir, also brought great quantities of almug wood and precious stones from Ophir. So she had some ships go a long way around and bring rare exotic woods and rare and exotic things that were bulky, a little too bulky to put on the camel. She had them shipped separately. The king made steps of almug wood for the house of the Lord, for the gate of the temple steps, stairways. It's like having a redwood deck, only better. And also, she sent harps and stringed instruments for the singers. There never again came such almug wood, nor has the like ever been seen to this day. And King Solomon gave the Queen of Sheba all she desired, whatever she asked. What in the world would you give her if she's already that wealthy and he's already answered your questions?
Green card. Thank you for stopping by.
Yeah, thank you for coming to visit again, and let's stay in touch. You have instant messenger, and let's stay in touch. So she turned and went to her own country, she and her servants. The weight of gold that came to Solomon every year was 666 talents of gold. That's his annual income. Besides that, from the traveling merchants, from the income of traders, from the kings of Arabia and the governors of the country, and King Solomon made 200 large shields of hammered gold, 600 shekels of gold, shekel is 4/10 of an ounce, went into each shield. And he made 300 shields of hammered gold, 3 minas of gold went into each shield, and the king put them in the house of the forest of Lebanon, in his royal house. And the king made a great ivory throne, a hand-carved ivory throne, overlaid it with pure gold. The throne had 6 steps. The top of the throne was round at the back, and there were arrests on each side of the place of the seat, armrests. And 2 lions stood behind the armrests, carved lions. 12 lions stood there, 1 on each side of the 6 steps, carved lions. Nothing like this had ever been made for any other kingdom. All of King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were of pure gold. Nothing was made of silver. Silver was counted as nothing in the days of Solomon. You can't use that dinner plate. It's made out of silver. Cheap. Throw it out. It's plastic. The king had merchant ships at sea with the fleet of Hiram. Once every 3 years, the merchant ships came bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and monkeys. So King Solomon surpassed all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. And all the earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. Every man brought his present, articles of silver and gold, garments, armor, spices, horses, and mules, at a set rate, year by year, that his camel caravans had to make get in line to get into town. Solomon gathered chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen, which he stationed in the chariot cities, and with himself the king in Jerusalem. The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones. If you've ever been to Jerusalem, there's stones everywhere. He made cedars as abundant as the sycamores, which are in the lowland. Solomon had horses imported from Egypt and Keba. The king's merchants bought them in Keba at the current price, the very rare fine Arabian horses. A chariot that was imported from Egypt cost 600 shekels of silver, a horse 150, and thus, through their agents, they exported them to all the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Syria. So here's this guy that's got commerce and trade going on, and incredible amounts of wealth flowing through his palace. So this is what the guy's like here. So this is us. We can, as long as we're here, back and let's look at it. We can see where he got away from the Lord in the next chapter, 1 Kings 11. King Solomon loved many foreign women, as well as the daughter of Pharaoh. Women of the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, the Sidonians, and the Hittites. From the nations of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, You shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clung to these in love. He had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For it was so when Solomon was old that his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord and did not fully follow the Lord, as did his father David. Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on the hill that is east of Jerusalem. That's Chemosh is the god of Moab, of child sacrifice. That would be abortion type. Built an abortion clinic. And for Moloch, the abomination of the people of Ammon. And he did likewise for all these foreign gods who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. So the Lord became angry with Solomon, because his heart had turned from the Lord God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice and had commanded him concerning this thing, so that he should not go after other gods. But he did not keep what the Lord had commanded. So, and then come the consequences that God said, when you die, I'm going to divide your kingdom and take it away from you and give it to somebody else. So that's the background on this guy. Okay? Now we go back a little bit to. Yep.
Did he die a righteous man?
I think so. Yeah, he kind of came. You see, that's why I think I think the Ecclesiastes is right at the end of his life when he comes back to his senses. And he's saying, "Look, you guys, I learned some hard lessons, and this is what I found out about all of life." So I think that's the idea of this book. I think you have to put this at the end of his life, because at the very close of Ecclesiastes is a strong affirmation of God. But in the meantime, he's saying, here's all the things I tried that don't work. Here's all the things that I looked into that don't lead anywhere. Here's what happens if you go on this all-purpose investigation of life and you put God out of your heart. Here's what you're going to end. It's all ending in a futile. So nice to get this from somebody that's looked and is wise and rich and could afford to be systematic about it and could tell you what he found. That's the idea. Okay, where were we? Chapter 2, verse 9. We have these singers. And I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Yet my wisdom remained with me. He didn't lose rational control of himself. He's probably kept a journal, in other words. He'd probably stop and think about what every day had and write it down. This is what I learned today. This is what I discovered today. This is what I did today. Put it in a big journal. Yeah. He sort of got sorted out of his heart, out of his focus. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. Whew. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. Just imagine letting go of all the restraints and all the moral taboos and all the inhibitions and saying, I'll try it. I'll go do it. I'm going to see what it's like. That's just pure hedonism. My heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward from all my labor. I've got all this money, and I'm going to live the good life, and I'm going to see where it takes me. I looked on all the works that my hands had done and all the labor in which I had toiled, and I considered all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. So what did he get from his gardens, orchards, visitors, musicians, palace, staff, lifestyle? What was the end result of that? All said and done, what did he say about all that? Empty. Futile. That's interesting. How many very wealthy people are there living around here today that have much, much money and set themselves out to live a good life and have no use for God? And what and Solomon is saying, I did that. I did it more than anybody else did. And here's my conclusion. I really worked hard at this, and it comes to nothing. I turned myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly. What can a man do who succeeds the king? Only that which is already done. He's thinking about his sons after him, and what are they going to do? He's thinking about his own father David. What can he do that his father David didn't do? Or what can he do that no other king's ever done? What can you do that your parents didn't do? What can a man do who succeeds the king, or what he has already done? Then I saw that wisdom exceeds folly, as light excels darkness. What's that mean? A conclusion, preliminary conclusion. Wisdom exceeds folly as light exceeds darkness. We did say earlier, they said ignorance is bliss. But now Solomon's going to change that a little bit, and he's going to say, if I had to choose between wisdom and ignorance, or wisdom and foolishness, is there one of those that's a better choice? Yeah, wisdom's a better choice. Because
it kind of dominates over folly, like they contradict each other, but wisdom is always there at the end.
And if you're a real fool walking around in the dark, you could get yourself in all kinds of stupid trouble that if you had just a little bit of common sense, you'd stay out of. So this still, he just says, no, it's a little bit, it's a good idea to at least have a level head about you and not just wander aimlessly through life. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I perceive that the same event happens to them all. Look at that kind of humor in that.
What verse is that?
That's 2:14. Isn't that neat? The fool walks in darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceive the same event happens to them all. What's the great leveler in life? Death is the great leveler in life. Doesn't matter how much money you had or what kind of an education you had or whether you're wise or what you made out of your life. We all end up dead. Unless, of course, there's a God. Unless God can... There's something we don't know about life that you discover when you know God. This is not about despair. This book is not about life is hopeless and despairing. It just says, look, what are you living for? Why are you here? What's the reason? Doesn't much matter whether you're wise or rich or poor or famous or successful. If you don't have the purpose of life figured out, it's all in vain. Isn't that interesting? Look at all the people around you that are driven to success, to fame, to fortune, to wealth, that are compulsively driven to something in life that Solomon says doesn't lead anywhere. So I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, it happens to me. And why was I then more wise? Why did I bother getting all this wisdom if I'm going to die too, and the poor fool down the street is going to die too, and what's the advantage of all this trouble I've gone to? There is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever. Come back in 100 years and look at the gravestones and down in the cemetery, and in one grave there's a foolish man and the next grave is a wise man, and how would you know the difference? And who knows about either one of them? They're both forgotten. Isn't that silly? Who do you know that lived, what ordinary people in San Jose do you know that lived here 100 years ago or 200 years ago that were all living life like you're living life right now? Can you name them? Do you know them? Do you know about them? No, forgotten. that see how that look at the vanity that's in the human heart. How we all want to think that we are somebody. Well, you are somebody if you have a relationship with Jesus. You are. That's a whole different picture, which we get to later on in the book. But for now, look at how Solomon looks at all of life with this. What are you living for? Why are you here? Doesn't matter what you're doing. It's all empty if you have left God out of what you're doing. There's no remembrance of the wise. No more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever. Since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. And how does the wise man die? It's just like the fool. Whole generation of professors here, great professors will all be dead and gone in a few more years, and they'll all be replaced by a new generation of professors, and they'll all be dead and gone in 100 years. And the kind of futility in that. Where is it leading? Therefore, I hated life, because the work that was done under the sun was grievous to me. For all is vanity and grasping after the wind, the futility of life, that dreariness, the drudgery, and for what? And for what? Why am I doing this? I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me. Who's going to inherit my estate? Well, when Solomon died, it was his kingdom was torn away from him and his wealth disappeared. This happens to a lot of very, very wealthy people. They die miserable and lonely. And what happens to their estates? Well, their kids, the kids inherit the money. They generally don't know what to do with it. What do you have? Great mansions. Great mansions oftentimes get given to charitable organizations like Christian Conference grounds. And so why did this man build this big monument to himself? Who got to benefit from it after he was gone? So what's it for? See that? Why did I work so hard? And here, and my kids aren't grateful, and nobody appreciates it, and nobody likes my furniture, and I know they're just going to tear this house down after I'm gone. And all these mementos I've accumulated around here, all my trophies will get thrown in the dumpster. So why did I bother with all this? And Solomon should know. He's got plenty of trophies. Who knows whether the man who comes after me will be a wise man or a fool, yet he will rule over all my labor in which I toil and in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This is vanity. I'm going to leave my estate to my kids, and I don't know whether they're a bunch of jerks. They don't care. In fact, I spoiled them by leaving them all this money. They'd be far better off if they had to work for their own living, and I've handed them all my millions. And I don't think these kids are ever going to amount to much, maybe, but maybe not. How would you feel like having all of your affairs managed by some incompetent idiot after you're dead and gone?
I was thinking about all the gardens that he made. He's probably the guy after that.
We're gonna have a little garage sale and let's get rid of some of these. We don't need this ivory throne anymore, and we don't need these carved lions and all this clutter. Therefore, I turn my heart. So he's already looked in quite a bunch of things, and he's already coming up pretty empty. He says, I turned my heart and despaired of all the labor in which I toiled under the sun. There is a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. Something very, very unfair that you should work really, really hard to build something and then give it to somebody who's never done a lick of work in their life. Because it's valuable to work hard and to get something as the reward of your labor. And if somebody hands you something free on the platter, you never appreciate it so much as if you'd worked for it. So that he says that's it's vanity and a great evil. For what has man for all his labor and for all his striving of his heart, with which he has toiled under the sun, all his days are sorrowful, and his work is grievous. Even in the night his heart takes no rest. This also is vanity. Very wealthy people lay awake at night worrying about whether they're going the stock market's going to drop. Or whether the poor Carly, what's her name, the CEO from Hewlett Packard that just got fired, she only, her severance package was only $21 million. The poor woman, she's really, you can't live on $21 million. Now she's got to go get another job, poor dear.
Actually, she could live on $21 million.
You think so?
I mean, think about it, a house doesn't even cost that much.
I know, I'm kidding. But no, you don't. You know, I don't know if you know any really wealthy people. They're generally not. They generally don't sleep well at night. They're generally not very contented.
And they're not very nice.
And people are always trying to hit them up for a loan or take advantage of them, and they never know whether you're really a real friend or you just want to be around the rich and famous. And so it's true of a lot of rich people that they just are not.
Yeah, man, that's what they chose. They chose to make a lot of money, right? And then they chose the lifestyle where people, the anybody you know, people you're friends with, or having money or not, and your family too.
There's nothing better, or there's not really, there's nothing good in man that he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This, there's nothing inherently good, there's nothing intrinsically good that a man should eat and drink, and that he should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. For who can eat, or who can have enjoyment more than I? Now we're getting a secret. There's nothing inherently good in eating or drinking or working all in and of itself, even though that's from the hand of God and God ordains that we should eat and drink and work. Who can eat or who can have enjoyment more than I? What man that ever lived could have had more pleasure, more enjoyment, more knowledge than I did? For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight. Oh, this is actually a fundamental clue. But to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting, that he may give to him who is good before God. This also is vanity and grasping after the wind. Now, the secret of life is, how do you get happiness, pleasure, and contentment in the world? How do you get meaning in life? It's a gift from God. To whom does God give that gift? The person who tries hard? Oh. Little secret here, huh?
It seems like the opposite, though, happens.
It does seem like the opposite happens, doesn't it? And if you're foolish enough to leave God out of your life and accumulate riches and wealth, then God will use your riches and wealth, but he's gonna use it against you. He gives to the sinner the work of gathering and collecting, so that sinner can give it to the work of God in the long run. The sinner here is this rich man that leaves God out of his life. Now you begin to see that what Solomon's finding out. I cannot enjoy any area of my life unless God grants me that enjoyment and that peace and that contentment. And God will grant me peace and contentment in everything that I do if my heart is open to Him and I will allow that to happen as a gift. Now go back all over all those things that you were doing before Solomon and be in a right relationship with God, and then what? All these things that were empty and vain and didn't lead anywhere now become full of meaning. Doesn't matter. It's okay to be rich. It's okay to party in a sense. It's okay to live the good life. As long as you have God's favor, it will be meaningful and full. See that? Now you see what the answer to the futility of life is. God intends that everybody should work. God intends that you should eat, that you should have friends, that you should live in a community for everybody. But not everybody's going to find meaning in life, and meaning in life is a gift from God. Is that all the same big thing so far? There's no one thing, there's nothing wrong inherently in all these things that Solomon is doing. Nothing wrong in search for knowledge, search for wisdom, fruit trees and orchards and lavish parties and banquets. Nothing wrong in that in and of themselves, provided his heart is open to the Lord. And if your heart is open to the Lord, God will bless the heck off of you, out of you. That's why Jesus said, I came that you might have life and have it more abundantly, real life and have it more abundantly in the midst of everything you're doing. Not religion, not a square, uptight life of asceticism, necessarily. No premium, no great advantage to being wealthy. In fact, it is a liability, generally, but see what the book's about then. The book's about the vanity and emptiness of life, no matter how you live your life, no matter what you do, if you've excluded Jesus from your life and you've shut God out of your heart, everything leads to emptiness and nothingness. And you're not going to, you think you got some idea trying something new, and it isn't new. And somebody's been there before you have been there, and so you're not adding anything to the sum total. Put God in your life and it turns everything all around again. Okay? We talked that a long time. Is this all right? I'm going 90 miles an hour. That's two chapters. And Ray Sedman's website's got an excellent commentary on this, which is also in book form. Can I pray for us? Our Father, thank you for this incredible book of Ecclesiastes and this man Solomon. We feel like we've had a little glimpse into his throne room today and into his life. And this gifted, wise, rich man that you love very greatly, who was in a position to study and research all of life, and who went through this long period of his life in which he left you out of everything that he tried, and has come back to tell us that nothing works when we've excluded you from our lives. Help us, our Father, to allow you, to give you permission to be part of our thinking and our thought processes and our activities, and not to shut you out of our lives in whole or even in part. And help us that you could open up our eyes to the splendor of life and the pleasure of life and the enjoyment that you're prepared to put into everything that we do, even when it's doing the dishes and doing homework and doing drudgery. Practice of the presence of God makes it all of life worthwhile. And thanks for our time together, our Father, and thanks for your great love for us. In the name of Jesus. Great to see you guys again. I'm done. Hang out. 1 hour and 15 minutes, that's all.